Welcome to the Broadgate Social Podcast. I'm your host, Josh Duggan. I'm a recruitment consultant here at Broadgate, and in this episode, I got the chance to pick the brains of the ever-insightful Meredith Beeston, who's the Financial Crime Compliance Director at ClearBank. Listen in to hear Meredith's thoughts on the evolving think crime space, navigating paradigm shifts, the power of workforce representation, and a lot more. Enjoy. Thank you so much, Meredith, for joining us on our podcast. Just to start things off, are you able to give us a whirlwind tour of your career?
Absolutely. So thank you so much for having me. And to be honest, yeah, I am a financial crime compliance director now at ClearBank and have been in that role for a year. And before that was a senior manager in the financial crime compliance team. But to be honest, I never really intended to get into financial crime, though I don't really think most people do. It's not really a career that career counselors are advising you to pursue. I don't think most people know it exists, and I certainly didn't. So prior to all this, I was much more in the politics space. So worked at the British Embassy in the US for a time, did work at nonprofits and at think tanks, and then came to the UK to pursue a master's in war studies and wrote my dissertation on comparing traditional remittance giving behavior to the financing of insurgency groups within conflict generated diaspora communities, which is a very long and fancy way of saying I wrote my dissertation on terrorist financing. And so that led me to get a job in financial crime. I saw a job and thought, someone turned my dissertation into a career path. That's pretty sweet. That doesn't happen in humanities. So took the job in a financial crime consulting firm. And yeah, the rest is history.
Yeah, I think it's the same with recruitment as well. A few years ago, I didn't even know that it's a job to get other people a job and how it all worked. It's the same. You kind of just fall into it. And then in your, I know you've only been in FinCrime for a little while, but what would you say is the biggest industry change that you've noticed since starting out?
So when I started in financial crime several years ago, I joined at a really exciting time for the industry because I properly joined financial crime around 2016, 2017. And that's when you had some major changes happening, both in terms of the money laundering regulations 2017 or the money laundering directive number 4 in the European Union, which was one of the most substantial changes that we've ever seen when it comes to financial crime regulation in terms of really embedding a risk-based approach into our regulatory text and also increasing the scope of firms that came under the money laundering regulations and increasing the robustness of the controls that you were expected to have in place. So being part of a team that was helping firms to implement these regulatory changes was absolutely fundamental to my financial crime journey. So I think I joined at a really important time for the industry. The other thing that I would say is I joined at the start of the rise of the fintech sector, right? Most fintechs didn't really exist before about 2015, 2016, when I was starting to enter the sector. So I was able to specialize in fintech financial crime, particularly in the consulting firm I worked for, FinTrail, was very much specialized in that area, which meant that I got a lot of experience with tech implementation, because with the rise of fintech, you also had the rise of regtechs and finding really innovative ways to prioritize the customer journey, but also have robust controls at the point of onboarding and using things like machine learning to help improve transaction monitoring early days. And now we have even more advanced capabilities on that. So I think seeing all of that has been really impactful. And I think, of course, connecting this back to people and, you know, between a recruiter and myself having this sort of conversation, one of the big things I've seen as a difference with the fintech sector is that everyone was expected to do a bit of everything. So in a lot of banks, you have pretty strict silos between your sanctions people, your AML people, your fraud people. And in fintech, you didn't really have that because everyone had to do a bit of everything. And in really small fintechs, that meant even beyond just financial crime, you might also be doing regulatory compliance, for example. And I very much related to that because this was the case with a lot of the clients that I was working with, but also myself being in a small consulting firm and having to do a lot of business development, a lot of operations, human resources, finance, and having to manage the consulting job at the same time. So I very much am a big fan of breaking down those silos and giving people that broader generalist knowledge and those transferable skills.
Jack of all trades.
Yes, indeed.
Queen of all trades. And then I guess from a DIB perspective as well, because I mean, obviously we're listed on Innovent Finance's power list as well. So massive congratulations.
Thank for you. That.
And I know from a regulatory perspective, linked to DEI, so no new guidelines from the FCA PRA sets out, well, guys, we set out to change diversity strategies in businesses. So I think they listed that lack of diversity is a non-financial risk as well, which is huge to recognize that is a risk to a business, and to have those strategies and representation taken to board level is incredible. So do you think those changes are positively impacting the quality of company culture? And do you think that's filtering down into a company level? Or
yeah, I think we're starting to move in the right direction. Obviously, with diversity, equality, and inclusion, or equity, this is something that historically has been really led by champions within companies, as well as by external forces, and this general desire to do good, to recruit the right talent, to be attractive to especially younger generations that really value having an authentic workplace. Having that regulatory backing and push, though, helps bring all firms up to some minimum standards and expectations, which makes it a lot easier to make the case. I know lots of firms have wanted and succeeded in being industry leaders in the space. And at ClearBank, diversity, equity, and inclusion has been a fundamental part of our board strategy and our executive strategy for a number of years now. This isn't something that is only just coming up. But I think for firms where maybe they haven't had as much focus on this, having that regulatory push is going to encourage that. But it's going to take some time, right? I think we're moving in the right direction, but it's going to take time for that to properly embed and us to see the impacts from top to bottom. And I think that this can be said for a number of other regulatory initiatives as well that have been coming out recently, which are very much focused, whether that be on app scam reforms and fraud reforms, whether that be on vulnerable customer reforms, whether that be on the consumer duty. There's very much a push from the regulator to support initiatives focused on improving a firm's commitments and relations with their staff, as well as with their customers and the wider ecosystem, if you think about ESG, where all of those come together quite neatly. And I think what I've seen across a number of those is that you have key champions within firms that are pushing these. So, for instance, consumer duty regulation came out, what is it now, 7 or so months ago, and we have fantastic champions in terms of compliance and legal, but to really get that properly embedded is when you move beyond the need for those champions. Those champions are great at getting the ball rolling and promoting that company culture once you get your policies sorted and your outcome testing and all that. And it's getting people to always bring the conversation back to that topic. But eventually that happens enough times that everyone starts thinking that way. But it does take some time for that embedding to happen.
Yeah. I guess as well with budgets, like I've spoken to a lot of people that are just starting to create ESG teams and actually having budgets allocate and make those hires and start making those projects. So yeah, it definitely is changing, but as you said, it will take a lot of time.
And for us, we have a new head of sustainability, which is fantastic. So we have a couple of full-time resources devoted specifically to sustainability within ClearBank, which is fantastic. And I know it's something that we're continuously looking at. And there are a number of people who take time out of their day jobs, myself included, to focus on ESG, DEI. And that's also why, you know, part of the reason that I was included on the Pride and FinTech Power List is because of a lot of the work that I do in these spaces, in addition to all the fun financial crime regulatory compliance that I have to do.
All the important things. Okay, and then just speaking of culture as well, I know we've spoken about this in the past, but it's a space that's largely informed by bias. So how do we ensure that the harmful aspects of that don't negatively affect company cultures, and in particular, the ways we build teams?
It's a great question. And I think there's kind of two angles that I would take to it. So first, you need to make sure that you have the right hiring practices in place and that you're building your team in the right way. And that comes down to having good policies around hiring, both in terms of making sure that you're recruiting from a diverse pool of candidates, but also that the decision makers are from a diverse pool as well, so that you don't end up with overly consistent thinking or building a team where everyone looks or thinks the same. Once, though, you've built that diverse team from different backgrounds, and of course, I don't just mean your classic diverse characteristics, whether that's sexual orientation or gender or race, but also things like your education background, what region you're from, and what sorts of careers you've had prior to being within this particular sector and coming in with some sort of transferable skills. Thinking about all of those various different elements, once you build that diverse team, it's then about, as a leader of a team or as a member of a team, recognizing the bias that you have yourself and being willing to acknowledge that and take steps to address that. Again, continuing to make sure that there is diverse representation around the table when making key decisions, especially decisions that may impact customers. And then finally, being keen on building a transparent culture. I think transparency is fundamental because it's so easy to feel when there's a lot of groupthink that if you differ from that group, that you shouldn't speak up because everyone's already come to a consensus. You don't want to rock the boat. But you should. You should bring up challenges when there's a valid reason to do so, and you need to feel encouraged to do so. And that really comes down to managers setting the right tone, being really transparent and open to transparency and open to feedback. So I think those are so important to helping reduce bias, that people feel unafraid to call someone on bias. And of course, there are ways to do that diplomatically. Yeah. You don't go straight into a meeting and go, I think you might be doing this in a bit of a racist way. Can you tone that down? Obviously, you don't want to do that, especially if, you know, I mean, we all are just doing our jobs at the end of the day, and there are some people who will be affected by unconscious bias. So there are ways to communicate more effectively.
Yeah.
And anything that can be done, especially from HR departments, to help encourage training and awareness on these topics, I think the HR teams that I've worked with have always been fantastic in the level of resources that they have available, both a mix of mandatory and optional. And I think that's also really key.
Yeah. Yeah, we've done our fair share of unconscious bias training. It's just recognizing that you may have, even though you think you don't, I think when you realize that actually you probably do, you're just realizing that, acknowledging it and actively trying to make a change is the first step. And yeah, I mean, businesses can implement so many different things. I just said diverse interview panel. There's a lot of like AI tech tools coming out now to completely anonymize profiles and CVs to just focused on their experience. So yeah, there's a lot of implementation that can happen.
Absolutely. On the AI point, there's a lot of use of machine learning and AI also in financial crime, in addition to in the recruitment space. And then there are so many positive use cases. But one of the things that we've seen a lot with these systems is that they do adopt the unconscious biases often of their developers.
I've read it.
Yeah. So I can use a financial crime example, but I think, you know, even in the recruitment space, there are cases of this coming through. So examples are in the onboarding space, a lot of firms use selfie matching to an ID document. You've probably had to do it when applying for a bank account online or via an app. And when those algorithms are trained on predominantly white faces, they are less effective at correctly matching or mismatching darker faces. So thankfully, a lot of solutions realized this and have become better over the past few years. But if you went back in time, 5-6 years ago, it was quite shocking. So that's one example of so many where you have to be really careful when deploying AI technology, especially in areas like hiring decisions where you can have a material impact on someone's career, or in financial services where I could have a material impact on whether or not someone could open a bank account or not.
Yeah.
When you're deploying AI in those settings, you have to make sure that you're accounting for that potential bias. And so that, again, connects back to why it's so important to bring in the right talent and the right perspectives, because the reason some of these issues get detected is because you have a diverse pool around the table who can check and challenge those sorts of solutions and raise those potential risk factors where people might be unfairly denied positions, unfairly denied access to financial services.
I think I did hear about that in the news. That is crazy. Yeah, you think you implement this tool with the best intentions and then you don't realize down the line that it's almost an opposite of what it's set out to do. And then I know this is talked about a lot on a lot of different podcasts. Yeah, it's a hot topic, but how important is a sense of belonging in the workplace?
I think it's fundamental and it's very cliche, but representation does matter fundamentally. And that has been proven time and again, whether it's through anecdotes that we've all seen or through actual studies. Unfortunately, I don't have any references to hand. I didn't come here with my sources neatly organized, but trust me, representation does matter. And it's because when you see someone like you, it gives you, again, that sense of comfort and encourages you, maybe not directly, but at least indirectly, to feel more yourself in a workplace. And also from a firm's perspective, helps demonstrate that actual commitment to those values that have been set out at the top, to that board strategy, to that executive strategy. By having a diverse leadership, you can show in one way your commitment to actually living those values that you have set for yourself. And it can be a motivating factor for many people. So I think for me, one of the things that has always been such a motivating factor for myself, but clearly also in others, is when I've talked about my coming out experience as a bi woman, to then have people within the company who maybe had never come out come up to me and talk to me about their own sexual orientation, ask for advice, and then be encouraged and inspired to come up to their friends and family or to feel more themselves at work because they had seen me talk about my own identity. That is such an inspiring, humbling, and motivating experience, and clearly was motivating on both sides in terms of motivating them to take action in their own life and their own sphere in order to feel more comfortable and safer with those around them. And I think that that's so impactful in the workspace. We spend so much of our time at work to not feel like yourself in that environment, to not feel safe to discuss or be open about who you are. How are you going to feel safe to discuss other elements of your work potentially? You might continuously hold yourself back and be nervous to speak up, and that ultimately drags the whole company down if people aren't willing to raise challenges that can then be addressed.
Yeah, it is such a privilege for someone to open up to you personally. It's happened to me a few times, and it's, yeah, it is very inspiring. Okay, Fab, and then I know you're super passionate about this, and this has been coming up in conversation a lot, but in terms of early careers and entry-level positions as a recruiter, I've personally seen and observed that there's a lot of diversity at the early career stage. And then sadly, as you watch people progress and you look at the higher levels and into the board, sadly, that diversity does disappear. And I know you're super passionate about this and ways that you can create more accessible pathways and give people the tools and development and help retain that talent. So how can we create clearer pathways for those people?
Like you said, it's something that I've seen as well and that I am very, very passionate about. It's something where I've been quite lucky to work in diverse teams. It's something that I like to say a lot in terms of, you know, since working at ClearBank, both of my bosses have been women. My bosses are women. Our chair of our board risk committee is a woman. We have a very strong female leadership, particularly within risk and compliance, which I'm so grateful for. But there's a lot more to be done, inevitably, in every company in terms of offering opportunities up and down the chain, and not just in terms of gender, but also in terms of race and ethnicity, religious background, sexual orientation, the list goes on. So there's a number of things that firms can do. And again, I'm lucky to be part of a firm that does take initiative in a number of these areas. But first and foremost is making sure that your diverse pool of talent at the analyst level, at the mid-management level, has the right training and mentorship and support to build the skills that they need for further promotion. So again, I'm a big fan of mentorship. I have a mentor myself within my company. I also mentor two people within my company. And I think even when you don't have formal mentorship programs, you can go out there and build your own. You can find someone to mentor you. You can find mentees if you want to do some mentoring, because I do think mentoring also builds your skills up in terms of those soft skills that are so important for promotion. But you also need to be aware of the opportunities. A lot of firms will just go straight to the external market and make zero effort to really advertise to their internal candidates. And that's a real shame. You can lose out on some good talent by people just simply not being aware that it's there. So I think anything that firms can do to advertise explicitly to internal candidates is so important, so people are aware of the opportunities and so people are encouraged to apply potentially cross-departmentally. I think that, again, a lot of people have transferable skills and not every career move has to be up. You can move laterally. And that's something, again, I think that I've definitely seen some people who've made those lateral moves within my own firm, in addition to people who've made vertical moves. And I think that that is so important. And if you're not going to do that, even cross-departmental shadowing, or when you are thinking about things like mentorship, looking for a cross-departmental mentor or mentee can be really, really beneficial to help building out the sorts of skills that you need to continue to progress your career.
Yeah, it does says a lot. It does say a lot if someone quite senior has left the business and they're looking to hire externally and not even give people a chance to interview. Even it does say a lot. That is one of the main reasons why people do look to move.
Absolutely.
They're not getting the promotions or even that chance of a promotion or interview for a higher level. It is one of the main reasons that people leave.
Yeah.
I guess from a company perspective, what happens when these people from diverse backgrounds get stuck at a certain level?
Like you said, they might leave if they don't really have those opportunities. Now, don't get me wrong. I have met people who will top up their career,
yeah.
Whether that's because they just advanced really quickly through it and there's not really much further to go, or whether they are just really comfortable and confident in their ability to do that work. And that is absolutely fine. Not everyone needs to be climbing the career ladder all the time and going through all the steps. However, if you find yourself in a position where you don't feel like you can be your authentic self at work, where you don't feel like you can be challenged and heard, where you don't feel like you have people to learn from or people who inspire you, absolutely, you're going to end up in a position where you're going to be considering other options, where you will be getting more of those things that matter to you. So that's the worst case, is you will lose your strong talent because they don't have the ability to learn anymore. They don't have anyone motivating them. They don't have any source of inspiration for what they're coming to do. No path forward in any sense of the word, not just from I have an opportunity to add a senior to my title, but from the whole picture of learning and development.
Yeah. No, fab. And then lastly, I know you're not a mind reader, but what is your top prediction for the world of FinCrime this year?
Oh, I have two, but they're both fairly boring and things that I'm pretty sure everyone else in the industry is saying. We'll see if I can say them somewhat uniquely. Probably not. But the first prediction, of course, is going to have to relate to AI and machine learning. Now, I mentioned, you know, I've seen this bubbling around since basically the start of my career in financial crime. But especially after last year, it's really taken taken hold. And I think in terms of anti-financial crime teams using it both to help triage potential cases, but also to fine-tune rules and do more sophisticated things with larger data sets, we're going to see a lot of use of machine learning and AI. But also on the criminal side, the amount of sophisticated fraud that can now be committed using AI-related tools in order to mass send out messages or to tailor social engineering attacks with even more sophistication is quite a concern to me. So I think both sides need to be considered. A lot of people talk about what we as anti-financial crime professionals will do, but we need to be mindful of what's being done by the criminals as well with this growing technology. And then the second bit, somewhat connected, of course, for me, is fraud. So we have the app scam mandatory reimbursement rules that were finalized in December. It looks like that's going to be coming into effect in October. And that's going to be a massive change for the industry. Pretty much every firm now is talking about app scam readiness, what they need to have in place, building out better fraud controls, which is exactly what the government and the regulators were wanting to see. So it's clear firms are moving very much in that direction. It was already a topic of focus before this, but even more so now with that ticking timeline.
Yeah. It is so scary. AI scares me so much. I'm not a very tech-savvy person.
Mm.
I can't even connect to wireless maps to my laptop. So like the thought of AI scares me so much. And I've had people like get into my bank account from my phone number.
I'm really? Like,
yeah, I don't know how you've done that, but it's probably
absolutely. It's definitely a concern that a lot of have. You don't, even people who are quite tech happy, they can be so convincing sometimes. Yeah. A lot of these fraudsters, if they manage to reach you and get a hold of you,
yeah,
a lot of the things that we think are easy fixes, you know, oh, you just hover over the email and you can tell it's fake email.
Yeah.
Email spoofing has gotten so sophisticated and will continue to do so. A lot of the things that we think we can do to protect ourselves are becoming more and more out of date. And yeah, it's hard to keep up on, and especially with more vulnerable individuals, older individuals, younger individuals, yeah, there's even more risk.
Silly individuals. Yeah, absolutely loved having you here. So yeah, thank you so much for taking the time. We've got one final question. What would your best piece of advice for your future self be?
Not my best, my future.
Your future self.
I think my future self is going to be continuously overwhelmed by the amount of change, both exciting and terrifying, coming down the pipe. And so I would advise my future self to slow down, take a step back, and remember what's most important, because as passionate as I am about fighting financial crime and about promoting diversity, equity, and inclusion within my firm and within the wider industry, there has to be work-life balance. There has to be time taken to yourself to do some cooking, watch some Netflix, just go out for a walk, go for a hike, spend time with friends and family. So I would advise my future self to slow down a bit.
That's good. And not feel guilty.
Oh, yes.
I would feel guilty if I did all those things, but yeah, they're so, so important. Perfect. Well, thank you so much.
Thank you for having me. This has been wonderful.
Thanks for listening. Follow Broadgate Social if you want to hear regular insights from more industry experts. If you'd like to share your thoughts on the podcast or partner with Broadgate on your search for top talent in the financial services space, please visit www.broadgatesearch.com. Until next time, bye.